Good afternoon. Welcome to the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and we're very fortunate today to have as our guest Stephen Gowans. And Gowans has a wonderful blog called What's Left. And incidentally, also, he has a book coming out soon, Baraka Books, and it's called The Killer's Henchman, and if I remember rightly, the disaster of the capitalist response to COVID-19. So I really look forward to that. Stephen, thanks for being with us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be back.
Your article couldn't be more timely, in my opinion. I really urge our listeners to go to What's Left and read this. Its title is Sense and Nonsense About Ukraine. I want to start with this. What I'm hearing from all the pundits, and we do have an awful lot of pundits, it's almost three to a show, they all agree that Russia is doing mysterious things. It's kind of the old business about how it's an enigma wrapped in a question mark, wrapped in whatever Churchill had on his mind. And when they talk about our current dangerous situation, they're asked, well, what's going to happen? Will the Russians attack Ukraine? Many of them say only Putin knows. Only Putin knows what's going to happen there. From your article, I got the impression that maybe they're missing a point. At this historical stage, isn't the ball in the court of Joe Biden and his friends?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Joe Biden and his friends are the instigators of this crisis, and the crisis is one for Russia. Actually, it's not a NATO crisis or a U.S. crisis. It's a crisis that confronts Russia, and it's a crisis of increasingly provocative behavior on the part of the United States and its NATO alliance. And this has been going on, I mean, since, you know, the end of the Cold War, with this unremitting expansion of NATO toward Russian borders, an expansion that the United States said that it would not undertake. And there's been a lot of discussion about this recently about how the Russians have pointed out that NATO pledged that it would not expand toward the Russian border, and then some Americans saying, oh no, that's not true, that's a myth, or that's a misunderstanding. But it's actually, the background of that is actually quite interesting. Gorbachev had proposed a unified but neutral Germany, and Washington was adamantly opposed to that. Because a neutral Germany would deny the United States a pretext to station tens of thousands of troops in Germany. And a robust U.S. troop presence was seen as necessary to prevent either Germany from developing its own military assets and possibly one day challenging U.S. hegemony, and also from preventing Germany from restricting U.S. access to German markets. So as an alternative, Washington proposed a Germany integrated into NATO with the proviso, to make this acceptable to Gorbachev, that NATO wouldn't expand toward Russian borders. And Gorbachev stupidly accepted this proposal. And when Gorbachev agreed to this arrangement, a Soviet general was reputed to have raged, "We've lost World War III without a shot being fired." But since that point, I mean, NATO has expanded closer and closer and closer to the Russian borders, to the point that it was proposed that Ukraine and Georgia, former Soviet republics bordering Russia, would become members of NATO. This was proposed in 2008, but the French and Germans vetoed that because they thought that was just far too provocative. But in 2021, this was reaffirmed, this promised Ukraine membership in NATO was reaffirmed. I shouldn't go into the details yet, but on top of that, then we have this escalating military activity in Ukraine, also in the Black Sea, all of which eventually, I think the Russians have said, this is just becoming far too provocative. And we need to take measures first to protect our borders, and second, to suggest arrangements that are more congenial to our security, which, and essentially the arrangement is, or the proposal is, to make Ukraine a neutral state. Much as Gorbachev had been proposing that Germany become a neutral state at one point. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of neutral states in Europe. I mean, there's Finland, there's Austria, there's Cyprus, there's Ireland, there's Malta, there's Sweden. There's no reason why you can't have neutral states that don't belong to a military bloc.
Yeah. Well, by the way, that certainly makes the point, and a few people have raised this. The media has been basically blacked out almost any discussion of it. But of course, why do we have the expression non-starter for a proposal which would be mutually beneficial? If really the object is peace, trade, and of course, democracy tends to function a little better in peacetime. We have this rhetoric in the Globe, the Star, they all agreed. And I would like you to talk about our political parties too here at some point. But they all just bite on this word, this expression, oh no, that's a non-starter. Ukraine has to have the option, and we have the option of including Ukraine in NATO. But if you really, if you're looking for a reasonable, safe solution for everyone, the proposals the Russians make, why isn't it reasonable? What's wrong with it?
No, exactly. And I mean, the proposal, for example, that Ukraine become neutral or be a neutral state, not belong to any military alliance. And by the way, Yanukovych, who had been the president who had been chased out in a CIA-inspired coup, was someone who argued that Ukraine ought not to belong to a military bloc and ought to be neutral, which is probably one reason why the United States arranged to have him ousted. But what's wrong with this proposal? There's nothing wrong with the proposal, but as you point out, in the US media, the Western media, Canadian media simply point out, because US politicians say this, that this is a non-starter. And no one asks, well, why would it be a non-starter? Sometimes they develop this elaborate conspiracy theory that Putin realizes it's a non-starter and he's made this proposal because he knows it's going to be rejected. And if it's rejected, that provides him with a pretext to invade Ukraine. But this narrative is one which flips reality on its head and doesn't recognize that the United States and NATO are the aggressive parties, and suggests instead that it's Russia that's aggressive and Putin is trying to reconstitute the Russian Empire or to recover territory lost to the Russian Empire.
What he really wants.
It's entirely Russian-driven, and implicit in all this is this whole idea that the United States and the NATO powers are simply sitting back, minding their own business. They're a defensive alliance, not interested in aggression. They're not pressuring Russia. No, they have no interest in undermining defining Russia, even though the United States defines Russia as a revisionist power that needs to be contained and overextended. And so as a result, the party that's aggressed upon is now being presented as the aggressor. Everything is flipped on its head.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Stephen Gallant, and the blog is What's Left, where this whole matter is taken apart very nicely. Stephen, just to echo what you were saying, is thinking about how this all emerged and how they're saying, how the West is engaged in removing the last really popular leader of the country, Mr. Yanukovych. The Toronto Star has a headline on Sunday. It reads, Russia plotting pro-Kremlin leader in Ukraine. I mean, that does bring up the echo. There was a famous woman from the United States. There's also a now deceased Senator John McCain, all of whom appeared in Maidan Square with all the leaders. And my memory is that later we had a recording of, I guess it's Victoria Nuland, picking the leaders.
Yes.
I mean, here we are. The UK says, and then they say the White House agrees with this. So the UK and the US agree that the Russians are trying to pick a leader. Can you remind us? I mean, seems to me at the core of this is Maidan. What was Maidan about? Was that a revolution or a counter-revolution, or was it democratic? And wasn't there an agreement that if Yanukovych stepped down, there was going to be a free and fair election and all that?
Yes, exactly. But it was a coup. And I mean, that's well established now. And this idea that Russia is trying to pick a new leader to impose in Ukraine, I mean, is simply a kind of projection.
Yes.
Attributing to Russia what it is that the United States did in Ukraine. And, you know, I don't doubt for a second that Russians
maybe
are...
they're stealing our secrets. They got we had the idea first, but they, you know, something like that. They stole it.
They stole the US playbook.
Yeah. They got a hold of it somehow.
Yes, that's right. Well, it just shows how nefarious the Russians are. But of course, the United States isn't nefarious because this was a democratic revolution in Ukraine, or so we're led to believe.
Yes. Well, what about the, to my mind, and incidentally, and we're going to come to it during the interview, but the proposals made by Russia, but the Russians say, rightly in my opinion, that look, you do have a problem in Ukraine, and the world recognized that problem, and the UN got involved in solving the problem in the Kiev agreements, a Minsk agreement, I'm sorry. Is it a Minsk? Yeah, the Minsk agreements. And that involved direct talks between those unhappy Ukrainians in southeast Ukraine who said that they lost their rights due to the Maidan coup. And if you want them to be part of Ukraine, you have to talk to them. And nobody thought that was unreasonable. It doesn't seem unreasonable. But all the Ukrainian so-called leaders, those from Kiev, say, no, we want to talk to Russia. We have to talk directly to Russia. But because those people in southeast Ukraine are, since they are largely Russian speakers, somehow the political leadership in Kiev want to pretend that if you're a Russian speaker, then Putin speaks for you, which is not accurate.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the problems with Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine is a multilingual, multicultural country. It's a state. It's not a nation. I mean, it's not the Ukrainian nation within the Ukrainian state. It's a state that contains various linguistic groups. And what the United States did was look to Ukrainian nationalists who are anti-Russian to lead their state after they ousted Yanukovych, who was trying to bridge the gap between the Ukrainian speakers and the Russian speakers and recognize that this was a multilingual state. But if you want to draw Ukraine into the US NATO orbit, then who do you look to? You look to Ukrainian nationalists who hate Russia. And going back to 2014, once you have the coup and you have a coup which brings to power Ukrainian nationalists who hate Russians, what happens to the Russian communities in Ukraine? I mean, in Crimea, they said, well, we don't want to be part of this arrangement, so we prefer to be part of Russia. So they have their own, they have a referendum, and Crimea is then annexed by Russia. And then we have those in the Donbass, which is primarily Russian speaking, saying, well, we don't agree with this coup government, which is now anti-Russian. So we're going to establish our own government. And in the Minsk Accord, of course, suggests that there ought to be some autonomy for the Donbass. And one of the problems with Ukraine as a state, it's unitary rather than federal, as we have in Canada. So the provinces, there's no provinces with autonomy. And Kiev, the central government, says, well, we're not going to, you know, we're not going to introduce legislation in accordance with the Minsk Accords, because if we were to do that, that means that Putin's proxies in the Donbass would have too much influence. In other words,
which would take us back. Yeah, take us back to when Ukraine was functioning under Yanukovych, where they did have some say.
Right, but here we always have to equate Russians with Putin. So if you're Russian speaking in Ukraine, then you become a Putin proxy. Yeah. But it shows the extent of this Ukrainian nationalist orientation, which is vehemently anti-Russian, which of course is going to be backed by the United States. Mm-hmm. Because they want a government in the Ukraine which is vehemently anti-Russian and therefore pro-Western by implication.
Now, let's bring up Canada's role here. You devoted several paragraphs to them, and I was very happy to read that, because it is so striking on this as in other issues involving, I guess, this thing called the Cold War, is it... The parties in Canada, the parliament, are in lockstep with the government, except perhaps trying to be more aggressive and more, give them more weapons or do this, et cetera. Well, I'd like, actually, if you just comment on what this really reveals how the Canadian public is kept in dark, because those parties are not going to talk about any alternative. You would think the NDP would, but what is the NDP doing and saying?
Yeah, well, and as a lead into that, I should point out what exactly it is that Canada is doing in Ukraine. And we should be asking the question, why are we even involved? I mean, Ottawa's committed $700 million in military assistance to Ukraine since 2014. So why are we spending $700 million on Ukraine? We have 200 Canadian Armed Forces troops in Ukraine with rotations every 6 months to train Ukrainian security forces. And we're not the only ones there. There are dozens of NATO countries with special forces in Ukraine training Ukrainians.
Training.
The Liberal government says it's deliberating on sending a warship to the Black Sea, which is provocative, deploying CF-18 fighter jets currently stationed in Romania, inviting the question, why do we have CF-18 fighter jets in Romania, but deploying those to Ukraine, another provocative move, and then also expanding the contingent of 200 Canadian forces personnel in Ukraine. So what does the NDP say about this? You know, the NDP presenting itself as the peace and love party. They say, well, you know, we shouldn't be arming those Ukrainian troops, but we should have sanctions because they're the better option. And Heather McPherson, the foreign affairs critic with the NDP, said that she would like to see Ottawa impose sanctions as a warning to Putin, because she says nobody wants war, but our priority should be using economic and diplomatic sanctions to de-escalate the situation and deter Russia from further aggression. And in doing so, then they accept this distortion of reality, which says that the Russians are the aggressors rather than the United States and Canada and our NATO partners are the aggressors, doing things like deploying fighter jets to Ukraine and sending, you know, Canadian forces personnel to train Ukrainians, et cetera. And then also, I mean, this whole idea that sanctions are somehow peaceful is absurd. I mean, sanctions are simply an alternative way of waging war, and often a much more vicious and harmful and destructive way of waging war than by firing guns and missiles. I mean, there was that famous paper that was written in 1999 in Foreign Affairs called Weapons or Sanctions of Mass Destruction that had pointed out that there were far more people killed in Iraq by sanctions than had been killed by all the weapons of mass destruction in history. So here's the NDP trying to present itself as, you know, peace lovers, still proposing what's essentially a form of warfare. Sanctions are a form of warfare.
And they do not tend to reduce tension. Things are sufficiently tense, one would think. Both language and, of course, the action itself hardens and sharpens the differences. It is a really curious situation. And also, this thing about the media, you touch on that. There is no major publication I'm aware of, and certainly I watch the various networks, that even identifies what it is that is being said when they talk about, well, what is Putin thinking? Well, they don't. Why don't you ask him and just tell me what he said? Instead, we get interviews with people who are experts on him, and they will talk about what he said. On this matter of what they say, I never see them use a word, which when I read, and I do look at the Russian media, they use in discussing how to have peace, to achieve a reasonable solution, they say the word security is something very important, and security has to be indivisible. It can't be security as defined by NATO, but that word, indivisible, I never see that in our media so that we could talk about, well, what do they mean by that? It's rather simple, isn't it?
It is, and another great omission from the media is we know that the Russians have proposed two treaties, one with the United States, one with NATO, and they expect or have asked the United States and NATO to reply in writing to their proposed treaties. But I have not seen anywhere in any major media any description of those proposed treaties or what's in the proposal. Mm-hmm. And if you find them and look at them, you see that the proposals are the epitome of reasonableness. There's nothing in these proposals that anyone could ever object to. And perhaps if the media had actually disclosed what was in this, it would challenge the whole idea that the Russians are perpetrating some kind of aggression, because this doesn't look like, you know, the proposals of aggressors. It's the proposals of someone who, of a party that's trying to establish a peace between itself and another military bloc.
Let's go through those. The draft, you, and by the way, another really good reason to read the What's Left blog by Stephen Gowans, most recently this discussion of the sense and nonsense about this crisis over Ukraine. There are 6 points here, and you nicely lay them out. Number one, it says Russia and the U.S. shall not use the territory of other countries to prepare or conduct attacks against the other. Well, how about that? You know, but incidentally, Stephen, you underline something too that I've noticed that they are not discussing. Russia is being very direct. And by the way, and that is the most, I'd say, the most serious part of this, because they don't seem to be kidding anymore. They said, someone said, well, why doesn't Putin meet Biden? Or maybe that we should get another meeting of secretaries of whatever. And they say, no, here are our written proposals. We want a response in writing. That's kind of important. In your article, you say that the U.S. defines its position as pretty much whatever it decides when it wakes up in the morning. It's the political conduct, the morals, whatever is whatever they decide that day. I mean, they give themselves total latitude, whereas this is now a confrontation saying, here's our proposal. That way you're going to have to stop kidding, right?
Yeah, and then you're referring to the so-called international rules-based order, this nice rhetoric that's always bandied about and suggesting that Russia does not want to obey the rules-based international order. When you interrogate, well, what is the rules-based international order? It's whatever the United States says it is. At any particular time, whatever is convenient for the United States. If you look at, you know, the U.S. security strategy documents, the U.S. defense doctrines, they all define Russia as a so-called revisionist state or a revisionist competitor. What do they mean by revisionist? Well, they want to revise the post-Cold War security order. In other words, they want to revise the way in which the United States has established its hegemony throughout the world. And the whole idea is that the world has, by US definition, the world order is one that serves US interests and no one else's interests matter.
Yes.
Or at least the US interests always come first and other countries are not permitted to assert their interests. And that's why, and they're quite open about defining Russia essentially as a challenger, is because Russia asserts its interests. Russia says our interests cannot be subordinate to your interests. We have to arrive at some kind of agreement, some kind of mutually acceptable way to interact, a modus vivendi. But that is intolerable to the US point of view, which is, our interests come first, yours are subordinate. And if you don't agree with that, then you're a revisionist power and something must be done about you.
I noticed that the number six of their draft treaty with NATO says neither party shall regard the other as an adversary or create threats to the other. And all parties shall commit to settling disputes peacefully, refraining from the use of force. Again, that is so striking. You, as you said earlier, that's very reasonable. Why, under what international law do you get to treat another sovereign party as an adversary? Why? Why isn't it condemned, actually? It does come close to, I should raise the issue of the United Nations, threatening other countries, threatening them with force, is a criminal, and of course using it is criminal, but the notion, which is deeply embedded in us in Canada and the Western powers, is that we can make people adversaries and somehow get away with that.
Yes. But then to justify this, then we have to pretend that they're somehow engaged in an aggression. And we turn everything on its head. One thing I haven't pointed out, one thing that really irritates the Russians is that this aggression has escalated. So for example, there have been US B-52s conducting exercises with NATO allies over the Black Sea. There US nuclear capable bombers flying through Ukrainian airspace, looping near Crimea, along with Ukrainian fighter jets. There's B-1B Lancer bombers training with Ukrainian jets near Russia. This has happened for the first time in 2020. Then one thing that is particularly provocative of NATO countries have been flying strategic bombers 20 kilometers off the coast of Russia over the Black Sea, at the same time conducting all kinds of exercises in the Black Sea. Canada talking about, and maybe we'll send one of our ships to the Black Sea as well. Because we have to contribute to this. It's just ridiculous what it is.
Proactive defense, preemptive defense. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, What's Left. Another element to it that I want to bring in and make sure we say, the Hitler and the Nazis and their allies were defeated by an entity that called itself and became the United Nations. And NATO was not created by the UN. It's this peculiar, very well-armed and aggressive gang. And I don't see, again, the NDP or political parties or anybody saying, why isn't this matter taken up there and resolved there? And by the way, it was, in a sense, some of these agreements, like the Kiev, the Minsk agreement, the UN says that's a good thing and we're in favor of that. So how did we end up following NATO and rather than the organization that defeated fascism?
Yeah, well, I mean, because NATO is one of the U.S. instrument for imposing the so-called rules-based international order. That is the order of asserting U.S. interests and making them supreme over the interests of anyone else. And of course, this completely rejects international law, completely rejects the U.N. Charter, which the United States has no time for anyway. And has developed something that sounds like the UN Charter, the rules-based international order, but it isn't. Yeah. And of course, we have this group of Russia, China, North Korea, Syria, Iran, and others who've developed the group, which is the Friends of the UN Charter in International Law, pointing out, just as you're pointing out, Phil, that there is something called international law. There is something called the UN, which is to address all of these matters. But the United States and Canada, as a good vassal country, has simply ignored all of this, preferring instead what Hugo Chavez once called the international dictatorship of the United States, which is what the rules-based international order is.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, and there's an element there on the matter of how the UN came into being, which was for humanity was a tremendous advance, since it declared the equality of peoples and sovereignty of states, small against large, and the use of condemned the use of force to settle differences, which we're now, as you point out, we're the U.S. tries to go around that. It does successfully, because everyone here is so swallowed the Kool-Aid, I guess you could say, and follows that. It is curious that we are allied with the two countries that are most important here, the country of post-Maidan Ukraine, which is basically the Western Ukraine, and the United States. And every year at the United Nations, there's a resolution condemning encouragement of neo-Nazism. And every country votes for that or doesn't vote at all. But two countries reject it, US and Ukraine. And Russia is periodically, they talk about the rise, the visible rise of neo-Nazism in Lvov, particularly, and Kyiv. And for again, that's a non-starter. The West said, oh, that's just that's a straw man, or that's, they have all kinds of terms. But neo-Nazism is literally involved here. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean that's part of the Ukraine nationalist orientation and part of the anti-Russian orientation. And also, I mean, there has been revealed, I think it was in the Ottawa Citizen not too long ago, that the 200 Canadian forces, trainers who are in Ukraine have been training neo-Nazis as well. I mean, neo-Nazis are part of the Ukraine military, and they boast about how, that is the neo-Nazis, about how they've been receiving training from these Canadians, and Canada simply goes along with it. And
those are the people called the Azov Brigade, right?
Yes.
And also on January 1st this year, there was a torchlight parade in the capital, Kyiv, of neo-Nazis. And the photos of Mr. Bandera, who was an ally of open and proudly of the Nazis, was celebrated. It's very interesting. The German embassy complained and the Israeli embassy complained. The Canadian embassy didn't say anything.
The Canadian embassy had to check with the with Washington first to find out what it ought to say or not say.
Yeah. What do I think about that? I guess would be what the first thing they would ask.
Exactly.
I was thinking of saying something, but I knew I have nothing to say, so you will tell us. I think it's very important. You know, something else I thought, we must keep the echo of World War II and how we happen to all be here. Donbass, by the way, was a marriage year area of Nazi advance and the defeat of Nazism. They're driven out of the Donbass, which is a very important piece of real estate. I was reading Bertolt Brecht the other day, as one to do, his journals, and Bertolt Brecht kept in his journals newspaper clippings. So in 1942, he had a newspaper clipping in English giving an account of a speech by Goering. And Goering said in the speech, we had to attack Russia because it was building up its forces in Poland. So let's move forward to, we have massing of troops inside Russia, massing of troops, which as George Galloway says, has been going on now for about 1 year. They've been massing. They don't seem to be very good at anything but massing. But go ahead, I'm sorry. It's striking. Mr. Goering kind of sounds like, I don't know, Biden or Blinken or somebody, that we got to do something about those Russians, you know, building themselves up.
Yes, it does. Very much.
It could be the basis of, already the West is saying, Putin's going to play a false flag game. Well, you know, that can go two ways, that idea. And if you continually talk about a guy who's in his own country, you know, basically, and how sinister all this is and how dangerous, you could actually convince yourself that maybe some type of provocation and stunt could be played off.
Yes, indeed. No, I mean, the propaganda is of the Goebbels proportion or character, not only in attributing or trying to justify your own aggression by suggesting that the other side is about to aggress upon you, but also making completely ridiculous, absurd statements like Joe Biden saying that a Russian invasion of Ukraine would be the most consequential thing to happen in the world in terms of war and peace since World War II. Completely effacing the historical record with all of the US aggression since World War II. If Russia ever did invade Ukraine, it would have to try very hard to even come close to matching what the United States has done in terms of producing consequential markers on the, you know, record of post-World War II war and peace.
Yeah. And by the way, you point out in your article, and I'd like you to talk about this, that NATO calling itself defensive is a joke. Why is that? Given Yugoslavia, et cetera.
And I mean, this is interesting because how do you reply to the Russians saying, well, we just want an arrangement. I mean, what security guarantees, that's all we want. And so if you're going to approve, I mean, that you have difficulty presenting them as aggressive if they're saying, I just want security guarantees. So what do you say? Well, why do they want security guarantees? We don't threaten them. NATO's a defensive alliance. I don't know why they could possibly find themselves to be threatened. And again, that completely alters the record because it ignores the fact that we had NATO aggression against Yugoslavia in 1999, NATO aggression against Libya, and NATO aggression in Afghanistan. All of these were unprovoked. This isn't a defensive alliance. It's an alliance of the United States. Not even an alliance. It's a tool of the United States. A bunch of vassal countries that do what the United States tells it to do, which occasionally means waging war on small countries that can't defend themselves.
Yeah, and you also point out that that's at their own expense. In other words, U.S. says to Germany, you got to help us out and you got to do this. Canada, et cetera. And they often are they lose possible economic benefit in order to please the US.
Yeah, I mean, all of the NATO allies do, because one of the things they're required to do so that their forces are interoperable with the US forces is buy from US arms manufacturers. So that's one way in which they lose, and the United States benefits. Germany, certainly, and France are not that happy with belonging to NATO because it encroaches upon the opportunities they have with Russia in integrating with Russia. And of course, Russia has this gravitational pull on Germany and France because they're close. Russia is a vast source of natural gas and energy. The United States doesn't like the fact and has never liked the fact that Germany relies on Russia for natural gas and has been making concerted efforts to undermine the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And perhaps the United States hopes in all of this that it's going to be able to pressure Germany to back away from Nord Stream 2. And yes, but that's part of being part of the U.S. empire, is that U.S. interests come first, and as a vassal state, your interests come second, third, or fourth, or really don't matter. What matters most are U.S. interests. So in Germany, yeah, we would like the Germans, say the Americans, to buy our liquid natural gas. Costs a lot more than buying gas from Russia, but, you know, you shouldn't be buying gas from Russia.
Yes. And we are still occupying you.
Yes.
You and Japan, we've benefited you by continuing to remain there.
One of the things I point out in my new book, although this might seem to have nothing to do with COVID, but...
Remind us of the book and the title while you're at it. Please, go ahead.
Well, the book is
The Henchman's Killer, Killer's Henchman.
The Killer's Henchman, Capitalism and the COVID-19 Disaster. But one of the things I point out was there was a really interesting interview done in 2002 by United Press International, by its editor, Borchgrave, with Alexander Haig, who had been, you know, the supreme commander of NATO in Europe. And that's something else about NATO, is that NATO is led by a U.S. commander. So it's a U.S. alliance. But and then, of course, Haig had been U.S. Secretary of State. And at the time, 2002, Washington stationed 70,000 troops in Germany at great expense to U.S. taxpayers. And we all know that prior to the demise of the Soviet Union, Washington had argued that the U.S. troops were stationed throughout Western Europe to, as they said back then, deter Soviet aggression. Now, you know, they're deterring Russian aggression. And Borchgrave wondered why U.S. citizens were carrying this heavy tax burden to pay for this immense U.S. military presence in Germany when the ostensible reason for the presence had dissolved a decade earlier. And Haig said, he said, well, there's a lot of good reasons for that. The presence is the basis for our influence. A lot of people also forget it's the bona fide of our economic success. Presence of US troops keeps European markets open to us. If those troops weren't there, those markets would probably be more difficult to access. And Borchgrave said, well, I didn't forget. I just didn't know that if the United States didn't maintain 70,000 troops in Germany, European markets might be closed to American goods and services. And Haig replied, well, you know, even with our presence, we've confronted protectionism in a number of industries, such as automotive and aerospace. So it essentially, he's saying, you know, the U.S. taxpayers have been paying to maintain 70,000 troops in Germany, not to protect Americans in any way, but to protect corporate USA from being locked out of German markets.
Yes, the danger that they would actually behave as independent, democratic, sovereign countries. Well, we've been speaking to Stephen Gowans, and you know, you led us to a really nice conclusion in your article, which to those of us who live in NATO countries who have nothing to gain and much to lose from the U.S. plutocracy's continuing predatory advances on its rivals, it is not Russians who are our enemies. Our enemies are the leaders of the column in whose ranks we are invited to march. I think you got it absolutely right, Stephen. Thanks very, very much for joining us. I hope everybody will go to What's Left, read this article, Sense and Nonsense About Ukraine, Stephen Gowans. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Phil.
This is CIUT 89.5 FM.